Good evening. I'm Karen Schramm. This is Jim Martin. We weren't planning when we came home for vacation. We weren't planning to do a big session, so we didn't bring a whole lot of notes. But many people approached us and wanted to just hear about our trip, hear about the Center for Global Service and Education, and ask questions. So that's what we're going to do tonight. First of all, a little bit about the center. I have a few brochures. Didn't bring very many, though, but maybe pass them around. Among several things we do, one thing is to organize travel seminars to Central America. Hopefully this next year we'll start doing some to Africa and Asia as well. The role of the travel seminars is to expose participants to the realities in the third world, the realities of poverty and injustice, and to help people reflect on the role of Christians in working for social and political change. Most of our groups are church groups. We were funded for the first year by the American Lutheran Church, so several of our trips have included mostly Lutherans. I just returned from a trip in November with the Iowa district of the American Lutheran Church. Our trip was to Mexico, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. It was the first time we had taken a group to El Salvador. The other leader, Pastor Daniel Long, had lived in El Salvador for a month, kind of as a security measure. He lived with the Lutheran pastor, so he wouldn't be picked up again. So Dan had contacts there, and that's why we were able to take that trip. A week after I got back, Jim went on another one of our trips that we organized through Luther Northwestern Seminary, and he went to Mexico, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Generally, they're two-week trips. The Mexico portion is primarily a time to examine the role of the church in Latin America. You talk with people in base Christian communities and get a general introduction to the issues of Central America, especially Nicaragua and El Salvador. So that's kind of an orientation time. There's 3 or 4 days in Mexico, and then you go on either to Honduras or Nicaragua. So what I'm going to do is begin to describe a little bit of my trip to El Salvador, and in so doing, you'll get an idea of the types of people we talk to and the intensity of the experience. The days are they're packed very full. And after I do El Salvador, Jim's going to describe a little bit about his trip to Nicaragua and Honduras. Okay. Since 1979, 750,000 El Salvadorans have fled the country. There's 250,000 displaced persons within the country. They live in what's called refugee camps, but technically they're displaced persons because they haven't fled the country, making them a refugee. And approximately 40,000 have been killed. And the estimates I've heard from like the Archdiocese office is that about 85% to 90% of those deaths have been attributed to the government, the soldiers and death squads, the government forces and not the guerrilla forces. Lately, the U.S. has been denouncing the activity of the death squads. It's really getting out of hand. We heard a lot of atrocious stories. The death squads are generally civilian people or heavily armed people dressed like civilians who are made up of former members of the military and current members of the military as well. So right now the United States is really putting pressure on the Salvadoran government to try to get rid of this death squad activity because it's getting harder and harder for our country to give military aid to the Salvadoran government when the human rights violations are just increasing all the time. When we first arrived in El Salvador, you feel the tension and the terror of the place. From the minute you get in the airport, they think now that the people that check your passports, the people that check your luggage, are all connected to the death squad so that they know as soon as you enter the country kind of who you are and what you're doing there. One of our first experiences, the guys that were checking our luggage confiscated a green t-shirt from one of the Iowan pastors. And he just thought that was a riot, and he just started laughing hysterically because it was his one dirty T-shirt, and he was so glad if they were going to take one, they were going to take the dirty one. And I looked around, and it was just total silence except for this pastor that was laughing. And I said, "Dwayne, be quiet." So he finally controlled himself. And I think the guards were so taken aback with this laughing person that they gave him his shirt back. But that's just the feel of the place just gives you the willies. In most airports in Central America, they're close to downtown, so you have a lot of beggars and a big mix of people. The Salvadoran airport is like 45 miles outside of San Salvador. So the only people you see there are either soldiers or suspicious-looking people or the rich. And the road between San Salvador and the airport, because it's so far out in the boonies, that's where a lot of the disappearances happen. You may have noticed, my father pointed this out, in the Vespers when I said been disappeared, it sounds like I'm misusing that word, but that is now a word they use in Spanish. It's more than, if someone disappears, that means they may have just left the country or gone underground, but to be been disappeared is taken from your home and either killed or, who knows, captured, kept, I don't know. So if you hear me using that, you'll understand that that is not my grammar. It is a word now in Spanish, and that's the phrase people use. So anyway, the first night there, we talked with Ricardo Stein, who is the head of a documentation center at the University of Central America. I quickly discovered that in El Salvador, it's dangerous to be a professor, a pastor, a doctor, a social worker. The university's been bombed 17 times in the past 3 years, and this man, Ricardo Stein, has been educated in the United States. He spoke perfect English. He doesn't have to be there, but he's going to stay. The documentation center he works for analyzes all of the periodicals in El Salvador, as well as periodicals from around the world, and they're committed to recording the history of El Salvador that's occurring right now. He shook the entire time. He could hardly hold a cigarette. His eyes were bulging. I mean, it was just an incredible experience. This man had read his name on a death list a few days before. His wife stood outside the door the entire time. You know, he didn't know who we were. He was just willing to talk to these North Americans, knowing that he could be picked up any time and killed. And so our group felt a tremendous amount of responsibility to come back in this country and tell what we saw, because here are these people that are literally risking their lives right in front of us to tell us their side of the story. And he really thinks it's important. That's almost the only hope they have. The same way in Nicaragua, it's the only hope they have is, in a sense, to tell North Americans and try to get their side of the story back here. One of his insights that I found very interesting, his apocalyptic scenario for El Salvador will be that, well, evidently the United States has stopped 7 or 8 coups from happening from the ultra-right. And he's afraid that finally the United States is going to decide not to stop one of these coups, let the death squad, the ultra-rights, kind of take over the country, and then the U.S. would have a perfect pretext for coming in as a peacekeeping force. Right now they're propping up this centrist government, which most people don't think is very centrist, but anyway, and that's just not working because the death squads are getting out of hand. So he's afraid that they might just kind of back off and let this coup occur. So I don't know, I hope not, because that would be really bad for the Salvadoran people. What else are we talking about? Just a note about when we were in El Salvador, the hotel we stayed at was downtown, and we obviously had a man that was assigned to our group, and it was almost comical. I mean, he always stood in the lobby, in the bar, in the restaurant, wherever we were, just kind of standing around, and it was almost as though it was like out of a 1940 movie, because he didn't have sunglasses, but he'd sit behind the potted palm with a newspaper. I mean, it was just absurd that everyone knew who he was. We all just go, there he is again. you know, again, that just kind of feel of just always you're just uncomfortable. We were there on a Saturday night at 9 o'clock in the capital of the city, and no one is out. There's no curfew, but everyone knows that they shouldn't be out after 10 o'clock at night. You drive down the streets, and there's just guards holding their guns just like this. Most of them are teenage boys, 13 and 14-year-olds, just patrolling the streets. It's really a weird feeling. Our primary contacts in El Salvador was the Lutheran Church. You can't really go to El Salvador and talk to the opposition. You know, they won't trust North Americans. You can't really get the other side. So our primary purpose was to just visit with the Lutheran Church and see their ministries there. As I said, in Vespers, they're suffering increased repression. They're not doing subversive work in our eyes. I mean, theologically, they're a very conservative church. It's not like they're preaching politics from the pulpit or anything. They're not really into liberation theology. They're doing humanitarian work. They've set up a refugee camp that houses about 700 families. We visited that camp. We visited a medical clinic that the Lutheran Church is involved in. What else are they doing here? Anyway, just lost my train of thought. We also talked to the U.S. Ambassador, Thomas Pickering. The U.S. Embassy, it's like a fortress. There's 2 foot wide concrete walls with a steel turnstile, so only one person can get in at a time. We were very fortunate to have the ambassador talk to us. Evidently, they got a call from Washington, D.C. saying, let this group see the ambassador. Now, we don't know why that happened. Some of the Iowans think it's because I was one of the first primaries or something for the election. But anyway, we got to see Pickering. It was very discouraging. He talked for 50 minutes straight, super fast. You could hardly take notes. He went through, I mean, he started his lecture with the fact that San Salvador is closer to Houston than Houston is to Washington, D.C., and therefore we have geographic reasons to be here, and we have altruistic reasons to be here because United States is a government that is pro-human rights, and, you know, he just went on down the 4 D's, democracy, defense, and
development.
I forget what the last one was. But anyway, so he allowed approximately 10 minutes for questions, and you know, our group just had tons of questions after all they had seen and heard. His basic line, when you really pushed him, was that the United States is going to continue supplying military aid to El Salvador, because if they didn't, it would become another Nicaragua. So our group was really curious to see what this Nicaragua was going to be like. I'd been there before, but no one else had. So the next, 2 days later, we flew from El Salvador to Nicaragua, and just as soon as we got off the ground in El Salvador, you could just feel this kind of sigh of relief. I mean, the terror and the fear that people have to live with constantly is just, it's just indescribable. And the Lutheran Church just asked us over and over to communicate to the Lutherans here how much they appreciate our prayers and their support. The pastor says, you know, I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for the pressure that you Lutherans put on our government to get me free. And now, of course, they're getting to everyone else but him in the church. I mean, the church secretary and the church accountant, the people that were directly involved with the refugee camp, they're picking them up now. So he's very, I don't know, he's really
upset.
Yeah, he's really upset with it. And right now they're trying to get North Americans to come and live there again. Right before we had come, when they picked up those other people, there hadn't been a North American there. So now it is really necessary that there's someone there constantly staying at the church. Because there's soldiers that watch the church constantly, who comes and who goes. So I talked to the pastor's wife, and she just described the fear every time her children go to school. You know, you never know if they're going to come home or not. So
elaborate on what you mean by the North Americans living. Why is that important?
It provides security. It's really difficult for the El Salvadoran soldiers to come into a place and take someone if there's a North American there, because then the North American can identify them. And, you know, the U.S. government has a lot of power there, and so they're not going to come and take someone if there's a North American in presence. So, and like, I was really nervous. The people that drove our buses, the Lutheran volunteers that drove us around and fed us in their kitchen, I mean, that's a real risk too. And we asked, you know, isn't this dangerous for you to be doing this for us? And they said, no, it's a real security measure when you come. But I was really afraid when we left what would then happen to them. But right after we left, a North American was there again. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim, and he can describe a little bit about his time in Nicaragua. We basically saw the same people that he did. So.
Yeah. I went down with a group of 20 seminarians from Luther Seminary in St. Paul. We spent about 5 days in Nicaragua, and we got there by changing planes in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and then flying into Managua. And after we stayed in Nicaragua for 5 days, then we flew back to Honduras for a couple days and spent some time there with some folks. I mentioned the stopover in Tegucigalpa because the landing there in Honduras was a similar feeling to the stories Karen tells me of landing and walking around the airport in San Salvador. We got off the plane, and you can't explain these things, but everybody sensed panic and terror and a lot of anxiety, okay? Well, there are good reasons for that. First of all, when we got off the plane, we were being videotaped. This is in Tegucigalpa. Then as we got into the lobby of the airport, we met a German camera crew and whose correspondent came over and began to talk with us, and he said, I was just curious as to who your group is, and I told him. And then I realized, ooh, wait a minute, who am I talking to, you know? And then I started to be more guarded about what I said, and then this fellow went on to say, well, I'm curious because when we were waiting in Mexico City to catch our flight, to catch the same flight you were on, I noticed a man walking around taking pictures of all of you. And I walked up to this man and I said, excuse me, what are you doing? And the man wheeled around, looked at him, turned right around and left. Now that's what's going on. People, whoever's going to Nicaragua gets photographed. If you're a North American, that's just the way it is. Now I don't know who's photographing who, but that's part of what's going on there, and you can understand the kind of anxiety that fills people's lives as they go from border to border. The interesting thing is that when you land in Nicaragua, and we landed it at night, I don't know how to explain this. Maybe it's being set up with preconceptions, but I landed there and I got off that plane and I didn't feel anxiety. I felt warm because it was warm and it was humid, but that humidity sort of embraces you and you feel welcome. There weren't soldiers walking around. The only people that really bothered us were little children this high who kept jumping up trying to grab our pens and pencils because they wanted to read and write. In Honduras, they jumped up and down trying to grab our food because that's all they wanted at the moment, because that's all they can, that's where they're at. They don't have it. In Nicaragua, we met with a variety of people. Like I said, we were there for 5 days. But basically, we met with a lot of high-powered individuals. When we were in Mexico, we met with some campesinos and a woman who lives in a squatter settlement. When we were in Nicaragua, we went to one of the poorest barrios in Managua and visited with the sisters who work with those poor people. But most of our time was spent with basically the movers and the shakers of policy. We had meetings, a two-hour-long meeting with the U.S. Ambassador, Anthony Quainton, which was different than Karen's meeting with Pickering. He didn't dominate the conversation. The entire 2 hours were spent in question and answer. And as far as I'm concerned, he didn't deliberately try to lead us astray. And he deliberately chose not to emphasize certain points which he knew wouldn't hold up, wouldn't hold water. I think that's my opinion. And we can talk more about that. We visited with various folks in the Sandinista hierarchy. The woman who's in charge of the defense of the area around the city of León, which is a very large and very important area. We met with the editor of La Prensa, which is sort of the most outspoken critic of the Sandinistas in press, and they are also the most heavily censored critic of the Sandinistas in press. We also met with his brother, Carlos Chamorro, who is the editor of Barricada. We listened to a lecture which was videotaped for a North American audience by Thomas Borges. We met with Sophia Clark, who is the woman in charge of the North American desk at the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry for 2 hours. We met with Bismarck Carballo, who is the assistant to the Archbishop, another major critic of the Sandinistas, and visited with him for quite a while, and then also with Gustavo Parajon, who's the director or president of a group called CPAD, which does a lot of development assistance and does a lot of, I guess, kind of advising for the Sandinista regime. And there's just so much there. It's hard to know where to start. But in Nicaragua, let's just suffice it to say that I was amazed that this country was under the threat of invasion, because you didn't get that impression. People were just going about their everyday lives. In Mexico, we received a lot more animosity from people than we did in Nicaragua. No one ever said a bad word to me the whole time I was there. In Honduras, they won't look you in the eye. And I mean that. Not a single person will look you in the eye. Another important thing that I came away with was speaking with Sophia Clark at the Foreign Ministry Office, and we were pushing her on what Nicaragua would do if the United States invaded. And I kept asking other members of our group, well, what are we going to do when the U.S. eventually invades Nicaragua? And she finally said, if the U.S. invades Nicaragua, it's over. There's no point in trying to win it at that point. I mean, lots of people are going to die. The Sandinistas are going to fight to the last person, and they mean it, and they will. But if it gets to that point, it's basically over. And so Sophia Clark said, what we are doing now, and what we have been trying to do for the last 6 months, is fight like hell, nonviolently, to keep your country from invading us. And that really was an important point for me, to come home and realize that to fight the war after it begins in an invasion is not the right thing to do. But the right thing to do is to begin fighting now, and telling people the stories that we heard. So, I don't know.
We just add something there. When you go to Nicaragua, I was there originally in May of 82, and this in November, I did feel that the people were more conscious of this invasion. One morning, our bus driver was an hour late, and I was so angry, because if your driver's late, it just throws off your whole day's schedule. And I said, Jose, what happened? He lifts up his hands and shows me all these blisters and says, well, I was up all night digging my bomb shelter. I'm sorry, I overslept or something. So all of a sudden, my schedule wasn't so important. But they're out digging their bomb shelters. There's a lot of people with arms now. There were more checkpoints on the roads. They estimate, I mean, Nicaragua's population, the whole country, is 2 million people. It's very small. And they estimate that 130,000 people are armed now, and that's the difference between armed people in El Salvador and armed people in Nicaragua. I mean, Nicaragua, they're young teenagers, they're old mothers, grandmothers. Just an example of this, one day we were coming home and our bus broke down. And as is usually, when something spontaneous happens, it often is the best part of the trip. And we broke down in this small little town, and here 21 gringos get out at 10 o'clock at night, and we were walking down the street, and there's about 50 teenagers out for militia practice, all with their guns. I mean, it was like home ec class. This one girl had the thing sticking in her rifle, you know, what's this? And they were all chanting these anti-Yankee chants. And we just walked right through them, and all of a sudden they stopped and started talking to us and shaking our hands and asking us questions. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And that's kind of the feel. I mean, they're going to defend themselves because they don't want to go back to a Somoza-type dictatorship. But the way they treat North Americans is just incredible. Yeah. I mean, I recall in this country how we treated anyone Iranian during the Iran crisis in World War II the way we treated Japanese. Well, the Nicaraguans are able to separate individual North Americans from our governmental policies, and it's really an incredible thing to experience. Should we just go for questions?
Yeah.
Why don't we just open it up for questions?
The population of El Salvador, when you gave the number missing, dead, and having left the country, that's compared to what population total?
I think it's like 10 million.
Six million?
Okay. So Nicaragua's really small. I mean, they're underpopulated compared to the other.
Yeah, Nicaragua's like 2.9 million.
Yeah, 2 million, I think.
Yeah.
It's as incredible as it sounds, it's subversive to aid refugees, even though they're mothers and children. I mean, the death squad slogan, "Be patriotic, kill a priest," or they always say that a baby is a seed of a gorilla, so you've got to get the babies. I mean, the mentality is that if you're aiding displaced persons, you're aiding the gorillas somehow. It's really incredible. And the repression towards the Lutheran Church didn't begin until they started this refugee camp. So there is a direct correlation there.
Is the same true of the Roman Catholic Church? Are they being
oppressed? Uh-huh. Well, Archbishop Romero was shot, and the new archbishop is now speaking out and has had death threats as well. We also visited a Catholic refugee camp, and there's guards that sit around the top of the walls all day and look in. When we were walking through, the guards kind of disappeared, and every time you turn back, they'd be popping up, and then when you turn around, they'd disappear again, you know, so it's really weird.
Did you get much sense of that, or did you ask the end of
it? Yeah. Let's put it this way. Several different things are there. One is that when you land in Honduras, in Tegucigalpa, you get an immediate sense of an American presence, but it's not the military, it's the commercial, it's American free enterprise. Virtually every sign you saw was advertising U.S. multinationals' products. The reason that we didn't see as many military people there as I would have guessed is that there are three major airstrips and bases in Honduras where these troops are located, and they're not located in Tegucigalpa proper. So we didn't get to see the 5,000 to 7,000 American troops that are in Honduras right now. But I can say this much, while we were there, I counted, and twice as many American transport planes and helicopters took off than commercial or private traffic did from the airport. Virtually like every 5 to 7 minutes, something would land, and more than twice the time it would be a U.S. plane. So that gives you some idea. As far as collusion between the Hondurans and the Salvadoran armies, we spoke with one of the associate directors of Catholic Relief Services in Honduras. And he said that yes, there has been some cooperation, particularly in cases along the border where the Honduran army would not allow fleeing Salvadorans to cross the border, and so the Salvadoran army would have them pinned and they just slaughter them. That's it. They just slaughter them, drive them into the river and kill them. We spent a lot of time when we were in Honduras at the embassy with this fellow from CRS and with the director of the Human Rights Commission, which is an independent group, trying to ascertain the power of the American embassy in Honduras and what kind of power we have in terms of shaping Honduran domestic policy and foreign policy. And at the embassy, of course, we got the line that, no, we're just here to tell them what the Reagan administration's foreign policy line is and to hear what their response is and to communicate that. That's what a foreign mission is supposed to do. Then we spoke with this fellow from Catholic Relief Services and from another fellow from CODE and from this fellow, the Human Rights Commission. All three of them were very hesitant to be too specific because they all said, frankly, we would like to live. And we're not interested in dying, so there's some things that we can't say. But we can say this much, that when, and this is true from Karen's trip, I think, or maybe it was two Catholic bishops, when two Catholic bishops asked the president of the country about the 32 assassinations which have occurred in Honduras in the last year, and about the many disappeared people, the president of the country said, "Well, I'm afraid you'll have to speak with General Alvarez and Ambassador Negroponte about that." Okay, now that ought to tell you something. We spoke also with the director of the UN High Commission on Refugees. They are adamantly apolitical. Their presence in those countries is there solely at the grace of the host government, and if the host government says get out, you get out. No matter what the UN, no matter what the representative nations would like, you have to get out. So they're very apolitical, and this Swiss director sat there, and I asked him, I said, "You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but can you tell us the extent to which the American ambassador plays a role in shaping the policies of Honduras?" And he smiled and leaned back in his chair, and he said, "Well, I don't want to say more than I can say, but I can say this much, that in my relationships with the Honduran government, specifically and only about refugees, because that's all he talks about, yes, on one occasion we submitted a proposal, and it was said straight to us, the embassy won't go for that. We came back, submitted another proposal, and they said, the embassy will go for that." That's all he said. Okay. Now that might tell you the extent to which at least we are involved in the workings of the Honduran government.
I heard Honduras called the U.S. aircraft carrier in Central America. I mean, the amount of, I mean, for example, we've built the biggest field hospital in the Western Hemisphere in Honduras, and we have medics on call there in case of war. And that hasn't been published the way this woman that told us has found out from mothers of some of the medics that have been put on call, especially Mennonites that have been trying to publish this news because not many people know about it yet. But basically in Central America, the Lutheran churches that are there are very conservative and they're not really involved much. Many of them still are German-speaking churches or churches for foreigners that live in those countries. El Salvador has Missouri Synod ties, the church there, and I don't think they're too happy with the way the church has been involved in refugee work, but it's a real small minority. The ALC has just decided to put two missionaries in Central America, so that's exciting. And they had, for the past year, they have funded Philip Anderson, a pastor who lived in Bogota, Colombia for a while, to study and write on the Central America issue. So we're doing a little bit there, but there's not many Lutherans.
They're real focused, and you mentioned refugee life. That's really what they're there to do.
Well, they've only recently gotten into that. They're a congregation, and they have their ministries, and one is this refugee camp, and one is this medical clinic. But the repression is coming because of the refugee work.
Is there any sign that the overtures from the side of the Nicaraguan government for negotiation with the United States is getting any response that you know of? I mean, you mentioned, Jim, that
if there were an invasion, it would be all over, and what's happening is to try to avoid that. And the papers report a lot of overtures to the side of the Nicaraguan government.
Right. So you're speaking about the sending home of Cuban advisors. Is that basically what you?
Yeah, and there have been several things which sound like Nicaragua wants.
Right.
What you said you have been told. I'm just wondering if you heard from the ambassador or have read in the papers or heard from anyone else that we have responded to those offers. That's essentially what they are. Have we made any positive responses?
Slight, I think. The Nicaraguans have been bending over backwards. I mean, to the extent of where I think they're almost losing some of their integrity. I mean, it's just been incredible. They've done this all along, but especially lately, they've just been bending over backwards. And Joel Muggy, my boss, who led Jim's trip, felt that when he was there this a couple weeks ago, that the Nicaraguans were cautiously optimistic, is the way he termed it. They are sensing a slight shift. Kissinger evidently might sit down with them and talk, I'm not sure. But I think it might be changing a little bit. I don't know.
What I had heard before I went on the trip was that Nicaragua's latest peace proposal or response to the 8 basic points that the United States holds in contention, that Nicaragua's most recent response was viewed by Secretary Schultz as, the Mexico City Times said that that Secretary Schultz gave the highest praise he's ever given in response to anything that the Sandinistas had sent. And in the same breath he said, but of course this will have to stand up to evidence. If they follow through on these things, that's great. Apparently in that, Nicaragua was talking about lessening
censorship,
announcing the date for elections, announcing an amnesty for mosquitoes. An amnesty for anyone who opposed the country and left or just left the country and wants to come back. When we were there, I don't remember how many of the Cuban advisors had left. Is it 4,000 to 6,000 are there? Yeah, it's basically the teachers that have left Nicaragua. It happens to be Christmas vacation, just like it is here. Odds are good they'll come back. You have to weigh some of these things to some extent. When we were there, Pedro Chamorro, the editor of La Prensa, admitted to us and had said, no, I'm not going to lie to you. Yes, it's true that censorship is lessening to some extent. We are still censored all the time. But things that would have been censored 2 weeks ago are not. The Sandinistas said that in January of 84, January 21st, they will announce the date of the elections in 1985. But see, that isn't really new news. The Thomas Borges and Sophia Clark were kind of mad because they said, the Reagan administration is standing tall and proud because they're saying that their foreign policy, which has been to harass and to invade through proxies of the Contras, Nicaragua, and kill Nicaraguans, the Reagan administration is saying that our policy is forcing the Nicaraguans now to set a date for free elections, and that just is not true. The Nicaraguans, since 1980, have said that they will hold elections in 1985, and they have never changed that. They have never, ever said that they will not hold elections before or after 1985. They've always stuck to that year. They just hadn't named the date. But then again, how many people name a date 6 years ahead of time? Karen and I are getting married in August. We don't know the date.
I'm not sure about these figures, but I think there were 140 nuns and women clergy that were going to vote upon the list. 40 of them landed, the plane was surrounded, they were called subversives and not allowed to enter. Why are religious people called subversives and who calls them that in Honduras? Is it the Hondurans or is it us or what?
Okay. Well, there are lots of points on that one. The plane, there were two planes, one from Miami, one from New Orleans. The one of the planes got off the ground. The other one got stopped in the U.S. and they wouldn't even let him go. The other one got to Honduras, landed on the runway, was surrounded by army, you know, army personnel, escorted to the end of the runway again and said, leave, basically. The U.S. Embassy said that they were kind of mad about that because they happened to have an attaché on the plane. They wouldn't let him off either. So the plane went right back to Miami or wherever the hell. As we understand it, the reason that they were turned away was, one, the nuns were coming on a tourist visa, and a tourist visa does not allow a tourist to protest against the domestic policy of a sovereign nation. You're supposed to act kindly, and you're not supposed to criticize your host. Good manners, good propriety. Okay, well, so that was the reason that the Hondurans sent them home. The fact of the matter is, and we discovered this after talking with the Associate Director of Catholic Relief Services, the fact of the matter is that that when organizations within Honduras found out that these American nuns were coming to hold a peace vigil outside of the U.S. Embassy, these organizations in Honduras, which live with tremendous fear of being repressed, these organizations began to spread the word that we will join the nuns at the Honduran embassy on December blah 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 to join in a solidarity protest. The word from this fellow at Catholic Relief Services is that the Honduran intelligence got wind of that, which isn't hard to figure out how, and they just decided that this was going to be too major a problem. It's one thing to have 140 American nuns. I mean, come on. What are they going to do? They don't even know anybody in Honduras. That's sort of a symbolic protest that you can deal with. But when it's your own people that are going to gather outside of the embassy, then a government perks up its ears. And I really believe this guy when he says that's why the Hondurans sent the nuns home, was because that would have given these repressed organizations the opportunity to organize and to join them in a protest.
It's interesting though, Joel's, the seminary group at the airport were asked three times before they were let into the country, were asked three times if they were a religious group. And Joel said, no, we're not, we're students. And they didn't even trust him. They went to ask one of the seminarian women if they were religious. She said, no. But evidently, National Catholic Reporter said that on December 2nd, the Honduran government issued a decree of some sort saying that any religious group had to get some special type of visa before they came to Honduras. So I'm curious to see how much longer we'll be able to take groups there.
Religious is the term in Latin America which is most often associated with nuns and priests. Orders.
I'm just going to ask what that included. Could they let secular groups in?
It's real weird.
For example,
it's real weird. I don't know. I think they have that decree so that they can use that if they need to, like to stop this group of seminarians. Even though you aren't nuns or fathers, they might use it.
Yeah. Joel was convinced that if he'd said, yes, we are religious, we would have been on the plane and gone home. But, you know, the Joel's running, I don't know.
I'm just confused because it sounded like you were responding to Mary's question saying that the fact that they were religious was the offense, but now you're saying the fact of a religious group is an offense.
I think basically the problem is that the women religious or the men religious priests tend to be the organizers of dissent. They were in Nicaragua eventually, and there are a lot of them in El Salvador which do take up the cause of the poor, and so I don't know if I'm getting at your question exactly, but I mean yes and no.
I think they use the decree to stop these nuns, kind of. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. If that that's why they're trying to keep away religious groups, because they inside with the oppressed.
Yeah. Now call us here. I mean, we're being pretty one-sided. You know, take us on. Really. I don't want to alienate anybody.
Yeah.
Just because.
I asked Cliff Lenny that religious question by this trip, and his comment was that the gospel sounds different. It's the same gospel, but it sounds different to people who are oppressed, like El Salvadorians, when you're talking about freedom and peace, and that becomes subversive in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read some of Romero's sermons, I was struck by the fact that it could have been preached at a congregation here in the United States, in reference to the gospel, a gospel sermon, just that in the environment it was preached in, it has that subversive ring to it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a question about basic information on El Salvador. The terror that people feel is a terror from, you said that most people attributed most of the right-wing death squads. The papers of late have talked about gains on the part of the left-wing guerrillas. And we talk about, reading the papers about deterioration in the government's ability to handle them. Even though you said that you weren't able to talk with leftists, do you have information about what kind of organization they represent or organizations? I mean, Nicaragua was a situation of clear, organized opposition to a clearly tyrannical regime. El Salvador sounds much more chaotic. If the leftists were to succeed, would you have a government out of that group, or would you have further factions fighting one another, or what?
In my opinion, you'd have further factions fighting one another. No. It isn't well organized. It doesn't have the. I mean, there's a lot of El Salvadorans who just want peace.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons the elections.
Everyone finally said, stop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because there is violence from the left and there's violence from the right. What I'm in favor of is negotiation with all factions involved. I mean, that's the United States, I don't think, is negotiating anywhere in the world at this point. I mean, it's just constantly, we're seeking military solutions all the time. And that's, yeah, I think if the left won, that it wouldn't be much better.
Are the elections anything but a sham? I mean, do they offer anything at all?
It offered, the people wanted peace, and the slogans for the elections was vote for peace. So there's a lot of dimensions to that. People had to vote.
The upcoming elections, the ones that are announced.
In El Salvador, the ones that are coming up?
In March.
I think it's still going to be a sham. But until they bring in, until the left feels safe enough to come into the negotiations and to participate in elections, they're going to be a sham. And I don't see that happening in the near future. A lot of people that we talked to had the sense that the guerrillas have won in El Salvador, but they haven't kind of come into the main city, the main capital, like they did in Managua, because they know the U.S. would be there the next day. But there is a feeling that in the outlying areas, the guerrillas have won. I mean, the army, the corruption in the army is just.
Do people fear the guerrillas?
Well, let me go to that. When we were in Honduras, this associate director of Catholic Relief Services had spent 2 or 3 years working in El Salvador with the services of that organization, and so he's been there quite a bit. He said like 1,000 times he figured out. Anyway, he said that in his association with the guerrillas and with the liberated zones of El Salvador, that, and he's this guy's from Brooklyn. He's kind of a curious fellow there. And he said, I don't say things like this. It's just not like me to say this, but I have to. The society that I saw in the liberated zone, were it not for a war condition, I would consider a model of an ideal society. He said, I'm not. He said, I realize that sounds like a real silly thing to say, or a real naive or idealistic or liberal or whatever, but he said, I've been here a long time. I've seen a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And he said, these folks have elections, they have teachers, they have doctors, they solve things without violence. They have a stable agriculture that produces things and people eat. He said, were it not for war, it would be ideal. Now, whether you know he can apply that to all the liberated areas, which comprise 40% of the country of El Salvador, I don't think he would say so, because Karen's right, there are various factions. But he did say that, and well, actually, he said this, but also a former Salvadorian officer whom we spoke to in Cuernavaca, Mexico, who is now a refugee, he told us that when the army captures guerrillas, they just kill them right there and then. They don't keep them because they don't have the food to feed them, and they don't have the time or the patience or the energy to keep them. When the guerrillas capture army personnel, they do not kill them. They keep them, they feed them, and they release them. They send them back. And when they come back, the army won't take them. And the army won't take them because they say that these people are going to demoralize the army. And in fact, that's what's happened. Some of the fellows early on did get into the army, and they started telling their comrades about how they were treated by the guerrillas. And they had people going on the other side and fighting back against the army that were former army men. So the Salvadoran army won't take back the prisoners that the guerrillas capture. They won't put them back in the army because they're afraid of the effects of those folks upon the morale. And that ought to tell you something.
What the people fear as far as the guerrillas, it frequently happens that the guerrillas will come into a town to get supplies and food and move on, and then the army will come in and wipe out everyone in the town for assisting the guerrillas. So that's a problem still. So people are fearful, but the violence committed by the left is far less than the right. A couple weeks ago, Reagan came out with a quote that most of the death squad people were guerrillas in disguise that were trying to discredit the right. You know, and that's, there's no truth to that. There's no truth to that. Yeah?
I just to give a slightly different angle on that, because I spent 7 months in Costa Rica, and I worked with refugees from El Salvador, and it's just, you know, you talk to people who have had to flee the country, and you just get such a completely different perspective than our press gives. I mean, in their minds, there's just absolutely no doubt who's responsible for the fact that they fled. They put all the blame on the government in this place. And you just cannot talk with a refugee without having them mention the family, you know, a close family member. They're lucky if it's only one who's been murdered. One of the most poignant times was I was with the children. We had Father's Day. You know, we went around the circle and kids talked about their fathers. Well, over half the kids didn't even have fathers. It's just so clear to them what the picture is like. That they have, what they keep saying is, the thing is so frightening, they have such faith in the ability of our people to eventually see past what our government is saying in this country. They keep saying, well, it's just a matter of time until the North Americans see that Reagan is lying.
Yeah, I often wonder, even if peace would come to El Salvador, what it must do to your psyche, the violence that the children are exposed to. We went to an orphanage that the Baptist Church has started. There's like 60 kids that live there, and I remember this one little girl who was 2 years old, probably. She'd been at the orphanage for 5 months and still hadn't said a word. And I asked the head mother or whatever, you know, was she mute or what? And she said, well, she was one that they found in one of these towns when the army came through and massacred everyone. She was one of the ones that had survived it. And, you know, over and over you hear about kids like that, and you just wonder how they'll ever grow up normally after. interesting.
That's something we heard all the time in Nicaragua, was that this revolution is for the children, and that we can't necessarily change the minds of a lot of adults, but for the children, we're going to make a better life.
Do you see peace coming to El Salvador without violence? I've known people and heard lecturers and teachers in South Africa and other places that say it will take continued violence, more than it's going on. From your being there, I'm just curious as to your reaction.
I think it could come without violence, but I'm afraid it's just like Nicaragua. Finally, the only way to get rid of Somoza was for Christians to participate also and for people to take up arms. You know, I still struggle with that a lot, but I don't know. I think it'll be a long road if it's...
See, the thing is that in Nicaragua, even the rich got with the Sandinistas in the last days of Somoza's regime, and the rich were with the revolution that finally did, and the church, and everybody was with the Sandinistas as they got rid of Somoza. But in El Salvador, you don't have a bastard like Somoza. You can't centralize all your anger and hatred on one person, and because of that, you can't unite everybody. And that's one of the factors. One of the reasons these folks, the death squads, are getting money is it's coming from U.S. funds that are going there, because some of these folks are in the military. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of that money, I've heard, is coming from Miami and the big honchos that run around there that pump money back and forth. And there's a plane every day back and forth to Miami. It's packed with lots of folks. You know, those people have to be contended with after a negotiating process and after somehow a government that is created that addresses everyone's interests. It's those folks, those expatriates in Miami with the big bucks that are causing a lot of problems right now for a lot of people. Someone's got to deal with them. And we've dealt with some of that stuff before in this country. We can step on people's necks if we want to. We can step on the rich just as well as we can step on the poor. So it seems to me that until the U.S. decides that it really wants a settlement that is broad and does represent everyone's interests, until we do, we're going to have what we got. Because we represent the rich right now. That's who we represent. We don't represent anybody else.
That brings a question to my mind. I've always had the feeling that international corporations have been played a big role in Latin America, say, for American defense in that area. We got to defend our interest in Latin America. We got to defend our interest down there. If we didn't send military aid to El Salvador, Nicaragua, wherever, would the fighting cease faster, do you think? Or, you know, with the less supply of arms? Or is it because we've got to protect these interests down there that we keep shipping arms in and that keeps things stirred up? Or am I off on the good?
Well, anytime you give someone a gun, you're escalating the violence. And we don't just give them pop guns. I mean, we give them the best we've got. The other side of the coin is that for instance, in Nicaragua, I mean, here you have a broad popular revolution, and Reagan's in D.C. complaining about their Marxist-Leninist bent, and you still have an economy which is 70% private enterprise. The entire petroleum economy of Nicaragua lies in the hands of Exxon, Shell, Standard Oil. Everybody is still operating. The pumps are running. 65% of the corporate commercial sector is still run by private enterprise. When the Sandinistas came to power and decided to bring about land reform, they expropriated only Anastasio Somoza's land. They didn't expropriate the land which was in the name of his dependents. They didn't touch that. They just got Somoza's land. Well, that added up to 20% of all the land in the country. Well, that ought to tell you something about Somoza. But, so still, 65 to 70% of the entire economy of Nicaragua is free enterprise. Now, you know, whether that would remain the case in El Salvador, I don't know. The reason it's that way in Nicaragua isn't really out of largesse. I mean, they're doing it because they have to get some export dollars. And if they turn everything over to state farms and cooperatives, they're just not as efficient at producing things as private property is or private ownership is. But as far as they're concerned, from everything I've read in land and in corporate commercial enterprises, Nicaragua's gone as far as it intends in terms of expropriating. So I don't think the United States has a lot to fear in terms of losing its commercial interests in El Salvador. I think we have a lot more to gain by promoting real stability in the region, by in fact negotiating some kind of settlement that addresses everyone's interests and everyone's needs. But if we go on supporting the rich, it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Seems kind of weird that we'd be supporting them in that light, or is it a fear of the rich themselves down there that if they don't get U.S. support, that they're going to fall under, and so that's why we have to keep supporting them?
I'm not sure I understood you.
Well, you say that the rich are the ones that are kind of taking over in El Salvador, aren't they? They're the ones that are...
The people in power.
Right? Yeah, people in power. If we quit shipping arms or giving them support, boy, they'd lose their power. And they're trying to tell us then that we'd lose a strategic point down there or something.
Yeah, they'd say it would become another Nicaragua, which, okay. I mean, when you say that in this country, that raises hankles in the back of your neck, and everybody gets, ooh,
yeah.
It's another Cuba, you know.
Yeah.
That's all they have to say.
What does that mean, another Nicaragua? You said that a couple times, and I'm not sure exactly what
Well, all it means is that, the Reagan administration has decided that they're drawing the line at Nicaragua, and there are going to be no more Nicaraguas. In other words, we're not going to lose face anymore. Basically, that's what it boils down to. We've lost control over a country in Central America. And if there's one thing that I came away with from this trip, and it is the realization that American foreign policy is not something that I can really explain to people, because it isn't really rational. It operates under a different logic, and that logic is imperialism. It is geopolitical hegemony, which orientates our entire foreign policy to that region. I'm not saying economic interests aren't at stake, because they are. But it's not that. It is an ideological conflict between the Reagan administration and the Kremlin, and Ronald Reagan has decided that he is going to fight communism, and it just happens to be that Central America got in the way. And so there are going to be no more Nicaraguas, because Nicaragua was eventually pushed up against the wall, and they took aid from the Cubans after they took power, and from the Soviets, and so Reagan's decided no more of those. I'm not sure that was very helpful. But.
Well, Nicaragua is a threat to this country. I mean, there is truth to the domino theory, because Nicaragua is a beacon for all of Central, all of Latin America. I mean, that's what keeps the Salvadorans, they're dying, they're going to keep struggling, because they see Nicaragua as such an incredible model. And so the Reagan administration is nervous about that, that if one goes, another's going to go. You know, in Guatemala, the same thing's happening. They're rising up because they see what can happen in Nicaragua.
So our foreign policy isn't on human rights. It's on...
I don't think it is.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah, that seems so bizarre.
So you're saying it is almost more of a pride thing, it sounds like, even more than what you're saying is a vested interest economically. You're saying that wouldn't be what would fall, but our national pride would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I cannot
believe that the Reagan administration really believes that Russians are involved in Central America. You know, maybe they do, but there hasn't been any real proof of that. I mean, Russia surely would like to help Nicaragua, but they're being real careful. They don't want to be a pawn of the Soviet Union any more than they want to be a pawn of the United States. But what I'm afraid of is if we keep pushing them, they're going to have to grab onto that help, any help they can get. That's why, you know, they've let Cuban teachers and doctors, not very many military advisors. I mean, the press here usually says thousands of military advisors. Well, most of them are teachers and doctors. They've let them come in. Cubans want to help. And they fought the Cuban Revolution for having Fidel Castro as the kind of person. You know, you'll find in Nicaragua that it's real complicated. You don't know really who's in charge. Different people take turns giving speeches. They have a rule that you can't have any living heroes. So, you know, when Somoza was there, he had his face and his statue all over the country, and they really got to just despise that. So now you don't see people's faces on the walls or statues. Or it's really
for one thing about Nicaragua, according to their Department of Foreign Ministry, they receive as much aid from Western Europe as they do from Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc. They receive as much aid from France, Norway, Sweden, Germany. You know, these are NATO allies. They receive as much aid, military and economic, from those countries as they do from the Eastern Bloc.
They really do want to a third way.
They're not interested in becoming someone else's puppet. They just got rid of one.
Karen and Jim, you were talking about the rich and everything. Well, I'm one that deals with that because in the Dominican Republic, in Santo Domingo, where I'm teaching third grade, and it's in a private American school there. And it's also Dominican children that go there as well. And it is. It's the very upper elite, you know, of that country. And so I'm almost opposite of what you're seeing. I'm seeing all the glamour and everything of that country instead of, well, you can't help but see the poor and everything, because that's just faced with you. You know, you can walk outside the school classroom or the school yards and you'll see that. And it's, you know, that's one thing that is very difficult for me in teaching there, is because, you know, you're teaching these children and you're trying to instill in them some concern and everything, but yet their parents, it's so easy for them because they can just buy their way out of anything. You know, even the teachers have been, you know, one of my other third grade teachers, you know, was bribed for her children to have one of her students. You know, the parent was going to give her money to try and give her, you know, have her raise up. You know, the student's grade. You know, they think that money will buy them everything.
And it has.
You know? And it has, yeah, it really has. And that's, you know, something that's difficult for me, because then you're downtown, you're just out on the streets, and you're having, you know, children come up to you, you have blind people that are literally in the streets. As you're driving down the street, you're stopped at a stoplight, someone in a wheelchair or someone pushing them in a wheelchair, or a blind person will come up to your car windows, you know, and ask for money, because there are no kind of government support for them. That's their way of living, is by that. You know, and you get to the point where you say, well, I've given to this, you know, where do you draw the line? You can't give to every single person that's on the street, but yet, you know, you don't know what else to do, you know, so you're hoping that other, you know, money that you're giving to other services, you know, will go to help those countries or help that area, you know, that you're, but it gets real frustrating too. You know.
Just the magnitude.
In the Dominican Republic, it's one of the better, I was told that it's one of the worst, but actually it's much better compared to many of the other islands as far as the literacy rate goes. They do have free schooling for universities and some of the poor, but you can still tell the difference. It's almost like there isn't really a middle class, but it's almost like it's a middle class, because then you still have the very poor who have to, you know, beg to get their money or to sell things at night. You know, you have children who in the bars are selling peanuts at night, and they are bringing home really the money for their family, and they'll be out until 3 or 4 in the morning. You know, and I've asked people, well, you know, do they go to school, or, and ask them, and they still get up and they go to school in the morning. You know, but it's a, you know, it's not a private school, it's a free type of schooling, but it, you know, it is there, and Catholic schools and whatever else. So the literacy rate there
isn't quite as high.
Yeah, isn't real high. they also, you know, they keep, the government kind of has a control on, you know, the basic type of foods, the milk and the eggs. You know, some of those foods, those they will not raise in price because they know that if they do, you know, what are the poor people going to
do?
Yeah. So, but it's still a real struggle, you know, and the times of uprising was in the, with the Grenada invasion, you know, and they had demonstrations and that kind of thing going on. And then Jean Kirkpatrick came down just a, you know, a short time after the Grenada invasions, and that kind of spurred things on again. You don't really see a lot of military out, but at that time, it was really out, you know, guarding the embassy and that kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's a lot, you know, I can see what you're seeing, but yet I haven't really experienced that because I work with a totally different class. And that's hard.
Well, really, that is exactly the image I had. I had actually the image of this kind of a cyclops with one eye just kind of stumbling around in its old age. And basically, I think that's what we've got. It's just a cyclops of an empire that's on its way to death, but it isn't quite there yet. And it misses the power that it once had, and now it just takes out its frustration on countries that are small enough that it can still push around. But so in one way, I'm pretty fatalistic about what's going to happen down there, at least with the Reagan administration. Mike Colonnese, who's a Catholic priest, really challenged us in Mexico and asked us, do you live in a political democracy when, if you dissent to American foreign policy, you're called a subversive? I mean, to dissent is just a dissent. That's part of democracy. But when people dissent, they're called subversives, or they're called dupes of the Soviets. You know, a subversive is someone who says, anarchy, let's have it. Throw away the Constitution. To hell with the Bill of Rights. You know, that's subversion. Dissent is a real different sort of thing. So I fluctuate between despair and our political process. When I think of my country and Central America, I don't think of Iowa and I don't think of Illinois, because they don't even know the damn thing exists. Most people can't even, don't really know which side we're on in El Salvador and Nicaragua, and that's what the polls show. So when I think of our country, I don't think of most of the people. I just think of a real stupid foreign policy. And I think of some people that really give a lot of credence to the power of the principalities and powers. And I don't know where to go with that sometimes. But what I do know is that to concede that and to say, okay, therefore we've got a demonic administration and the world's going to go down the tubes, and somehow to just let that happen is the final victory of evil. And to do that is exactly what this power wants, is for us to give up. So I don't know if that means we have to renew our faith in American democracy, or if we have to think of more creative ways to voice our dissent or create our dissent. But
I have a different feeling about that. I don't think that participation in dissent is for the sake of El Salvador or my country. It's for my own sake.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think God condones what's happening in those places, but what Luther says is that God's will happen whether we pray for it or not. We pray this petition that may be done among us, that the seeds of the destruction of evil are born within the evil itself, and somehow that thing is all going to come apart. As our participation in it exists, as it exists in El Salvador, by dissenting and speaking out and acting out as a Christian really has more to do with my personal salvation than I think it does the salvation of the...
Yeah, and you know, that's an interesting thing that a lot of people in Mexico said to us, perhaps you'll be the first Christian martyrs in North America. Perhaps you'll go back and you'll speak the truth, and because you're speaking the truth, you will eventually be persecuted, and that'll be your salvation. That's what they said. So, go ahead.
Well, why don't we officially break, and those of you that have more questions, feel free to stick around.
Sure, I just want to say one more thing. I think something, like Dan said that when they came back to China, they asked the Chinese Protestant church, you know, what could we do? And they said, you know, pray for us. You're not very good at that or something like that. You don't do that very well. I think that's true. I think the one thing you can do when I feel so impotent, so angry, and so frustrated with the best person I've ever been before, just how I feel when that's done or hearing you talk, the thing we can do is to just earnestly and fervently keep the slaughter of the innocents in our prayers and our memory. And when I don't see anything happening because of my prayers, for the guests here, we've had a prayer vigil every week during Advent, 24-hour prayer vigil in Central America and apartheid in South Africa and Nicaragua specifically. But I think that was a very powerful thing, and I just think we need to remind ourselves that that's something we can do when we feel we don't do it very well.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing this Father Colonnesi told us, too, that when you're dealing with such absurd violence, like in El Salvador. He lived in El Salvador for years, and some of the things he told us were just, you could hardly stand to listen to it. He said, when you're dealing with violence like this, all you can hope for is intervention from God. He said, political answers aren't going to do it. And just pray. He says, that's what you can do. So, yeah, thanks.